This Do Lectures episode features one of Canada's leading environmentalists, Bryony Penn, recorded live at the global event in California, USA in 2013.
Oh boy, how honored am I and how grateful am I to do lectures for allowing a forum where an aunt and the nephews, people come to listen to the nephews and the aunt and try and integrate the ideas of two generations. It's magnificent what you're doing. It was magnificent what you did this morning, so thank you. So welcome. I wanted to kind of say welcome to this small tribe because I was so inspired by Ken yesterday. Ken's a geographer. He doesn't probably know it, but he is. And I'm going to be talking to you about being a geographer. It's kind of an obscure thing. But it's an idea that whose time has come again. So let's see if I can click, point and click. It's on the computer. There. So speaking of small tribes, there's a tradition in Canada now that we always acknowledge the people that in whose territory we're sitting or living in and enjoying. And this was, In this case, I want to acknowledge the Pomo people. And this tradition in Canada came about because of an error in a map. And I, as a geographer, I always kind of go back to maps and the power of maps. But when people were making maps back in Europe many hundreds of years ago, they didn't know what was here at that time. And so they wrote this terra incognito across this portion of the map. And so for the last 300 years, people have felt that this was an empty space. This was an unknown space. And so when they came here, they came with the perception that there was nothing here. And in fact, even though when they arrived and there was people here and there was vibrant cultures and vibrant native communities of plants and animals, they still didn't see it because they had come with a map in their head that said it was terra incognito and that it was empty land. And so now what happened is that we actually never settled treaties in Canada. And so before any kind of event that happens now, we always acknowledge that. It's our way of trying to move the question, and the very difficult and uncomfortable question of us ourselves as humans inhabiting land and when we haven't actually negotiated treaties, and how we've brought our own cultures and imposed them on landscapes, and what the implications are, and how do we now, at this stage in our existence, how do we forge a new relationship, both with the land and both with the people that were living here? Because what, as you probably heard from Ken last night as we walked through this landscape and we walked the landscape today, these communities of plants and animals and the cultures, they had a lot of research and development, R&D for thousands and thousands and thousands of years. Evolution is kind of a big exercise in R&D, right? And so relationships are formed, intimate relationships are formed for over thousands of years. And a lot is learned about how to live well in a place, how to live sustainably. And the Pomo people, I imagine, because they share a landscape that is actually the same ecosystem that I live in, right up at the north end of this range. So I just wanted to kind of give you a brief introduction to this ecosystem, because it's also kind of like, it's also a bit of a personal biography for me, because I kind of feel like it's in my bones. And when I heard Gary talk and Ken talk, for any of us that have grown up in these places or fallen in love with them latterly, it gets into your bones and you become the biography. Your biography essentially becomes the biography of place. And geographers they're people that study place. And in the study of place, I think that there's a kind of a new way or a way back of forging a relationship that might help us through some of the problems. And the other thing I wanted to say is that as a geographer, I think this is a profession that is there for people that have this deep love of place and they want to try and figure out how they can live in that place and make a living and do the right thing about being there. And essentially it begins with love. And I'm going to start, this is me. This is about 1969. Any of you who've walked up in the trees will notice these oaks. They're amazingly gnarled, beautiful trees, and they're well adapted to drought. And so when I was quite young, I would go up and sit in these trees. I was always escaping from my brothers, the father of those two boys. You'll see a picture of them in a minute. So I would retreat up into the Garry Oaks, and I would sit there and I'd have these questions, and this is kind of like the birth of a geographer. I would sit there and I'd think, I had questions about, first of all, you know, what were those mountains over there, and why were they there, and what was that sea there, and why did they have the names that they had? Those mountains were called the Olympic Mountains, and I thought, well, that's kind of a funny name. And the sea was named after an old King George, and I thought, well, that's kind of a funny name to name after. And the oaks themselves were called Garry Oak, and the ecosystem didn't even have a name, and the city that I looked over was called Victoria. So these were sort of these questions I was asking myself, because I was trying to define my world. At that age, you want to sort of get a grasp on what your world is, like, what are the parameters, how does it work? You know, you're making all these little sort of assumptions and you're trying to figure it out. And then I discovered these kind of strange questions. I mean, these questions I had incomprehensible answers. So the first thing I discovered is that Victoria, the city that was lying there, was named after a queen that had died 100 years ago and had never visited there. And the mountains, the Olympics, were named after this obscure sporting event that was hundreds of miles, started, you know, thousands of years ago in another place. And I actually was sitting on a hill called Christmas Hill and discovered that it was called Christmas Hill because the Hudson's Bay Company that had settled this area had decided to sort of create a myth about finding the Indian chief's son on this hill on Christmas Day so that they had a reason to celebrate Christmas and sort of discredit the pagan stories. And so these stories to me, to some extent, were incomprehensible. But yet they were also part of they were also part of an interesting other history. Like, why were we naming these after these things? And why, what was the significance of all this? And so over the years, I started learning about these ecosystems, because up until then, there was really very little that was understood. The people that had really inhabited these areas through the same process that had gone on here had either been, their voices had been lost. The language, the Senchothan language, the last fluent speakers were dying off. So the stories, their stories were just on the stages of flickering out. The ecosystem was down to a very tiny, narrow kind of remnant of what it had been. But what I discovered is that these were incredibly culturally rich ecosystems. And the camas that grew in the wildflowers, those were all used as equivalent of potatoes and onions. There was virtually everything that you needed to eat was in this ecosystem. And I discovered that, in fact, little girls like myself had been sitting in those oaks for thousands of years, gazing out, asking the same questions, and sort of pondering their role in the universe. And this ecosystem that stretches, by the way, so I described it, just stretches all the way from just the north end of Vancouver, sort of north of Vancouver, and then midway up Vancouver Island. That was the northern range of an ecosystem that's really very significant in kind of today's context, because it's drought resistant. It's an ecosystem that's on its move. It's heading north. As we've all experienced, we're getting increasing drought, warming temperatures, increasing storm events. And so this ecosystem is creeping north, and I realized I was sitting that this frontier of a place that was going to be really significant, because what it holds in it is the genetic potential for how we're going to live in a warming world, because these trees are adapted to drought, but also that these trees and these plants and this ecosystem were culturally mixed. They were a cultural landscape. They'd been maintained by generations and generations and generations of women that essentially had gardened these landscapes. So when we look out and see this beautiful landscape, what in fact we're looking at was this place that had been nurtured and loved and essentially gardened for thousands of years. And when people are pulled out of that relationship, odd things started to happen. And so I realized, I thought, well, I just want to become an expert in this place. And so once you start loving somewhere, this is my brother, once you start loving somewhere, then you increase your knowledge about it, then you get into the place where you have to defend it. And I this was my little sanctuary, and they used to come up and bombard me with acorns and like hurl them at me. And so I would retreat into these little forts. And I think that these are the kind of pivotal moments that define where you're going for the rest of your life. I always say that the only reason I got a PhD was in order to say the same things that I was saying when I was six. But I just wanted someone to listen to me, and then I realized they didn't listen to me even when I had a PhD. So that's when I took my clothes off. But that's that's changed. And part of when I was growing up, this is the biographical part. Part of when I was growing up, there was the hill where I lived, Christmas Hill, you know, named after the Christian mythological tale. They proposed a big hospital. And I remember this very clearly because this was my first act of rebellion and civil action. I wrote a letter to the editor. And I said, you can't build a hospital here. This is a very beautiful place. I feel very happy and healthy here. So this is where you need to bring healthy people, and you need to put, you know, if you're gonna need a hospital, just bring all your sick people, and they can stay here and they'll feel better. And that was my logic at the time. To be honest, I don't think I was that far wrong. I mean, when you feel it, see how many people get sick in hospitals. And so that was my first act of civil disobedience. And then this other irony occurred. So the Hudson's Bay Company was the very company that was the oak tree that we have, that beautiful oak tree. It was actually named after the first CEO of this big box company, which arrived in 1848. So did my family. My family arrived in 1848. They were all part of the great colonization. And I noticed as I was walking up from Embarcadero in San Francisco that the company spread all the way down to there. So there was a landscape that was being created by the big box company starting way back in 1848. And I really, I reacted to it, right? But it was you weren't allowed to express your reaction to these kinds of landscapes because it wasn't deemed, you know, civic or, you know, public-spirited or something. So I always had this reaction to the obliteration of landscape and the destruction of it. And there didn't seem to be any discipline that I could kind of express my frustration about it, or at least even be able to talk about it. I would just sit. My mother would take me to these malls. I mean, it was kind of like, you know, the 70s childhood, been driven to these malls and forced into these parking lots and sitting in these dreadful. Anyway, it took me until I was, I went to Scotland to do a PhD in geography. I'd sort of meandered my way through geography because I loved the fact that it was interdisciplinary. I could study nature, I could study culture, I could sort of look at all these kind of interdisciplinary ideas, but really what I was doing was just being a good little tribal girl and learning about my place, everything about it. Where's the water? Where did the mountains get there, you know? Anyway, I ended up, the only place I could get a opportunity to get a degree was in Britain. I was going through the 80s and the recession. And I got there. And then, you know, there's statues of Victoria everywhere. It was like, oh yeah, I get it now, right? Empire. But Victoria, she'd been there. So it sort of made more sense that she had a statue. But one of the things that happened when I was in Edinburgh was, and where I was doing my PhD, was there was a project called Common Ground. And Common Ground was these two wonderful women that kind of were going back to an old arts and crafts tradition where they were trying to record in each of the sort of small units called a parish in Britain what was special about those places. And they commissioned maps throughout the entire country to celebrate what was special about this place. So that mapping project created the opportunity for everybody in that little geographic unit. It would be just like, you know, everybody in Hopland would get together and map what they cherished about that community. And that was a very different approach than how mapping is normally, where you hand it over to the professional, the cartographer. The professional is paid by, you know, particular interests who want to see their view of the land use and their view of the landscape mapped onto that map. And it's just, so going back to that first map I told you about, you know, whoever is mapping holds the power. So what was a real epiphany for me was seeing a community who took back the power of mapping to map the things that they cherished. And the things that they cherished could have been those Garry Oak Meadows, or, you know, their favorite pub, or a heritage barn. And you can imagine if you were mapping Hopland, you'd be mapping all these incredible layers of landscape, the complexity, all the things that make this place so special. So I took the Common Ground concept after I did my degree, and in fact, I didn't learn any of that during my degree. I learned that reading the Sunday Times and meeting these two women. But that's okay, I have my geography degree, and I headed back to Canada, BC. Go on. There. Okay, this is me pregnant. So I had my boys just a little bit after those two boys. And it's, I don't know about pregnancy, it does something crazy, you know, something goes snap in your brain. And I came back I'd been away for 8 years, and suddenly I saw this landscape just getting leveled. And this beautiful oak meadow that I'd grown up in was about to be turned into, you know, a massive subdivision. So I crawled up, literally I was pregnant, I got back to Victoria, I crawled out in the night and stuck up this big sign that said Zone for Oaks. And I remember sitting there, and I was sitting in this little spot, and there was an alligator lizard. And I don't know, yeah, I think you have southern alligator lizards down here, don't you? I'm really in love with lizards. In fact, I said in those little thing, you know, I'm looking for lizards and other interesting creatures. And people. I saw this lizard, and I thought, this lizard could care less. It could care less that there's a pregnant woman sitting with it in the bush. But I thought, you know, we are this sort of interesting little world, this amazing kind of, you know, we're related through, you know, a few million years, but. Anyway, I had this revelation in the ditch with the lizard. And I loved the fact that we had lizard posture too, because I get that one. Boy, I really get that one. In fact, our lizards, northern alligator lizards, don't do quite that same posture, but anyway, could go on about lizards for quite a while. So I put up this big Zone for Oaks, and it had absolutely no effect. I mean, I should have known. I had studied something. I should have known that just having this little act of defiance wasn't going to have any effect. So I realized, okay, that's it. I'm going to go into my professional mode, and I am going to integrate the mapping, policy, you name it, art, writing, whatever it takes to raise awareness about this incredibly beautiful landscape. Because not only is it beautiful, not only does it make me feel better than a Hudson's Bay parking lot, it's also really important. We're on the verge of a major environmental catastrophe with climate change, and we need to preserve the raw material for as the climate warms. So there was strong intellectual, strong emotional, and sort of, you know, I was being driven by the lizard to this mission. So I went into about 20 years of doing mapping workshops, getting into the communities, talking about the role of integrating in official community plans, going at the provincial level, getting policy. Gary Oak Meadows got declared as national species at risk, ecosystem at risk. So we got official and federal designation. And what I wanted to really emphasize here was that I created an entire career for myself. So I'm ever wanting to balance the sort of, you know, emotional with the practical. I managed to be able to put food on the table for my children as well as satisfy some deep, you know, driven ideological urge by a lizard. And so I think that what I realized sort of looking at it at the end of the two decades was that there is a space in every single little corner of the globe for people to take that kind of role of becoming an expert in their place, of forging a life and a way of being and helping to create awareness about the essences of place. Because in a globalizing world where everything is global, it's to go back to Wendy's, you know, the global is fine, but ecosystems work at sometimes at little micro levels. Like those lizards, they don't go to Singapore. They are there. They hardly move. I mean, they move quite quickly when they're warmed up. But in the winter, they don't move at all. And they certainly wouldn't do well in Singapore. So we have to be able to think at the local level. If we don't think at the local level, we will die because evolution doesn't work at a big global level. I mean, I think the only species that, you know, work at global levels are rats and possibly blue whales, and one's done well and the other hasn't. And that's, we need to have a few more eggs in our basket. So, okay, I'm nearly there. How am I doing? I'm really nearly at the end. Come on. There. So, oh yeah, I forgot to keep changing. So this is the end. The end. So this is my other plea, but I was trained as an academic. It was really just an end to a means, which was to be able, as you know, I could go back to Gary, when you love some place, you will do anything to protect it because it's an embodiment of yourself. And I completely destroyed my academic career by this. It was the end, because you can't have professors riding naked on horses down the main street. But the concrete outcome was that it saved thousands of acres of Gary Oak Meadow, and I think it raised two important issues, which is the science world. The scientists are saying very important things right now. We have to listen to them. The people that are specialists in the place. Ken is a specialist in his place. We should be listening to him. We've got to be able to integrate these voices that are getting increasingly shut down. And civil disobedience, if it's got to go to that, is not such a bad thing. And I just wanted to finish on this wonderful mapping project that we initiated. This was a collective, and there was hundreds, in fact, thousands of people. The mapping workshops over the years culminated for me in this project called Islands in the Salish Sea, where we had 16 different islands. The whole community got involved. People contributed in so many different ways. It was really an integration of science and art. Artists did the maps, but they worked with scientists, they worked with historians, they worked with old-timers, they worked with housewives, whatever. Whoever, everybody has an opinion and something that they cherish about a place. And capturing that really brings together community. And it's a tool, And I just want to encourage anybody that is, you know, at some stage has been a little girl sitting in a tree looking out and asking questions, continue to ask those questions and continue to use the tools, the old tools of the trade the geographers have been using to help further that curiosity about place. So, thank you.
The Do Lectures is here to share stories of remarkable people in the hope they will inspire you to go and do amazing things too. There are over 300 talks to listen to, or if you prefer, watch on our website, thedolectures.com. Hit the subscribe button on your favourite podcast platform to get the latest episodes when they come out.